My name is William Ellis, and this is an extract from Roald Dahl's Boy, Games and Photography. It was always a surprise to me that I was good at games. It was an even greater surprise that I was exceptionally good at two of them. One of these was called Fives. The other was Squash Rackets. Fives, which many of you will know nothing about, was taken seriously at Repton, and we had a dozen massive glass-roofed fives courts kept always in perfect condition. We played the game of Eton Fives, which is always played by four people, two on each side, and basically it consists of hitting a small, hard, white, leather-covered ball with your gloved hands. The Americans have something like it, which they call handball, but Eton Fives is far more complicated because the court has all manner of ledges and buttresses built into it, which helped to make it a subtle and crafty game. Fives is possibly the fastest ball game on earth, far faster than squash, and the little ball ricochets around the court at such a speed that sometimes you can hardly see it. You need a swift eye, strong wrists, and a very quick pair of hands to play fives well. And it was a game I took to right from the beginning. You may find it hard to believe, but I became so good at it that I won both the junior and the senior school fives in the same year when I was 15. Soon I bore the splendid title Captain of Fives, and I would travel with my team to other schools like Shrewsbury and Uppingham to play matches. I loved it. It was a game without physical contact, and the quickness of the eye and the dancing of the feet were all that mattered. A captain of any game at Repton was an important person. He was the one who selected the members of the team for matches. He, and only he, could award colours to others. He would award school colours by walking up to the chosen boy after a match and shaking him by the hand and saying, "Graggers on your teamer." These were magic words. They entitled the new teamer to all manner of privileges, including a different coloured hat band on his straw hat and fancy braid around the edges of his blazer and different coloured games clothes and all sorts of other advertisements that made the teamer gloriously conspicuous among his fellows. William Ellis, reading an extract from Survive the Savage Sea. The windless night filled our ears with unaccustomed silence, and in the quiet of the calm swell, the phosphorescent gleam of the large Dorado, streaking from under the raft and leaping high into the air to land in bursting showers of green glowing fire, was a display not often seen by men. The foul dryness of our mouths aggravated the discomfort of our sleepless bodies as we tried to ease the agony of our thirst, twisting this way and that. Then breathlessly we watched the gathering clouds obscure the stars, and as dawn paled the eastern horizon, it began to rain. A heavy shower this time, with a steady downpour. Slowly the water in the pipe from the canopy ran clear, and we filled our empty cans and spare plastic bags, our bellies and our mouths, until we could not force down another drop. We lay with our faces turned to the sky, and let the pure fresh water cleanse the salt from our beards and hair. Suddenly everything had changed from the shadow of the spectre of death to the joyful prospect of life, and all by a shower of rain. We would make the doldrums now. We lay uncaring, chewing strips of Dorado and revelling in the absence of thirst, talking excitedly of good food and watching the bulging plastic bags swing lazily from the roof of the canopy. We had water. Douglas, lazily watching the dispersing clouds, suddenly sat up with a start, pointing excitedly. A ship! A ship! It's a ship! We all crowded to the door of the raft, staring in the direction of his pointing finger. A cargo vessel of about 6,000 tons was approaching us on a course that would bring her within 3 miles of us. I felt my heart pound against my ribs. "Get out the flares," I said hoarsely, "and pass them to me in the dinghy. They'll see us better from there." 3 miles was a fair distance, but on a dull day like this, against a background of rain, they should see us easily. I clambered into the dinghy, and Douglas passed me the rockets and hand flares. My hands trembled as I ripped open a parachute rocket flare, and with a mute appeal to the thing to fire, struck the igniter on the fuse. It spluttered and hissed, then roared off on a trajectory high above the raft. its pinkish magnesium flare slowly spiralling downwards, leaving a trail of smoke in the sky. They couldn't fail to see it. I waited a moment or two, watching for the ship to alter course, then struck a hand flare, holding it high above my head. The blinding red light was hot to hold, and I pointed it away from the wind to ease my hand, the red embers of the flare dropping into the dinghy. As it went out, I struck another. Smoke from the first, now a rising plume in the sky. Surely they must see that. I waited a little, my hands trembling. "This chance might not come again," I said, anxious faces crowding the door of the raft. "I'm going to use our last rocket flare and one more hand flare." We watched tensely as the second rocket flare soared and spiraled, its gleaming distress message high above us. Desperately, I struck the third hand flare and held it high, standing on the thwart and holding onto the mast. "Look. Look, you bastards," I shouted. "Set fire to the sail," Lynn's voice. I stuck the flare to the sail, but it only melted. The ship sailed on, slowly disappearing behind a rain shower. And when she reappeared, her hull was half obscured by the horizon, 5 miles distant and disappearing fast. The time was 11 o'clock. My shoulders drooped. "We daren't use another," I said. "They won't see it now, and we have to keep something for the next one." We had 3 hand flares left. Lynn smiled cheerfully. "It says in the instruction book that the first one probably wouldn't see us," she said slowly, "and I'd already told the twins not to expect anything." She gathered the twins to her, comfortingly. We stared at the dwindling speck on the horizon and felt so lonely that it hurt. "I'm sorry, lads." I felt very tired. "We used to consider that one of the most important tenets of good seamanship was keep a good lookout. That lot seemed to be pretty poor seamen." William Ellis reading Mrs. Pratchett's Revenge from Roald Dahl's Boy. Our foremaster came into the classroom with a piece of paper in his hand. "The following are to report to the headmaster's study at once," he said. "Thwaites, Dahl," and then he read out the other 3 names, which I've forgotten. The 5 of us stood up and left the room. We didn't speak as we made our way down the long corridor into the headmaster's private quarters, where the dreaded study was situated. Thwaites knocked on the door. "Enter." We sidled in. The room smelt of leather and tobacco. Mr. Coombs was standing in the middle of it, dominating everything. A giant of a man, if ever there was one, and in his hands he held a long yellow cane which curved round the top like a walking stick. "I don't want any lies," he said. "I know very well you did it, and you were all in it together. Line up over there against the bookcase." We lined up, Thwaites in front, and I, for some reason, at the very back. I was last in the line. "You," Mr. Coombs said, pointing the cane at Thwaites. "Come over here." Thwaites went forward very slowly. "Bend over," Mr. Coombs said. Thwaites bent over. Our eyes were riveted on him. We were hypnotised by it all. We knew, of course, that boys got the cane now and again, but we'd never heard of anyone being made to watch. "Tighter, boy, tighter," Mr. Coombs snapped out. "Touch the ground." Thwaites touched the carpet with the tips of his fingers. Mr. Coombs stood back and took up a firm stance with his legs well apart. I thought how small Thwaites's bottom looked and how very tight it was. Mr. Coombs had his eyes focused squarely upon it. He raised the cane high above his shoulder, and as he brought it down, it made a loud swishing sound, and then there was a crack like a pistol shot as it struck Thwaites's bottom. Little Thwaites seemed to lift about a foot into the air, and he yelled, "Ow!" and straightened up like elastic. "Harder!" shrieked a voice from over in the corner. Now it was our turn to jump. We looked round, and there, sitting in one of Mr. Coombs's big leather armchairs, was the tiny loathsome figure of Mrs. Pratchett. She was bounding up and down with excitement. "Lay it into him," she was shrieking. "Let him have it. Teach him a lesson." "Get down, boy," Mr. Coombs ordered, "and stay down. You get an extra one every time you straighten up." "That's telling him," shrieked Mrs. Pratchett. "That's telling the little blighter." I could hardly believe what I was seeing. It was like some awful pantomime. The violence was bad enough, and being made to watch it was even worse. But with Mrs. Pratchett in the audience, the whole thing became a nightmare. Swish, crack went the cane. "Ow!" yelled Thwaites. "Harder!" shrieked Mrs. Pratchett. "Stitch him up! Make it sting! Tickle him up good and proper! Warm his backside for him! Go on, warm it up, headmaster!" Thwaites received 4 strokes, and by gum, they were 4 real whoppers. "Next!" snapped Mr. Coombs. Thwaites came hopping past us on his toes, clutching his bottom with both hands and yelling, "Ow! Ouch! 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 Ow!" With tremendous reluctance, the next boy sidled forward to his fate. I stood there wishing I hadn't been last in the line. The watching and waiting were probably even greater torture than the event itself.